You mean a tomb that it had a two-ton rock in front of it, a Roman guard, and a Roman seal. So that if you mess with that tomb, if you open that tomb, you risked your life. From Mark, we know that Mary had already had a conversation with an angel. She comes to the open tomb, and despite hearing that Jesus is raised from the dead, she did not need to cry. She just could not believe that. She dared not believe it. And so she flees the tomb, stumbles upon two of the disciples on her way out of the area. Happened to be John and Peter. Now remember, she had gone to the tomb with a group of ladies. An angel has spoken to her. Why are you looking for Jesus among the dead? He lives. She runs into two of her friends. And what does she proclaim out of John chapter 20, verse 2? She says, they've taken away the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they've laid him. She's clearly having problems with how what unfolded, right? She's not getting it. She's not expecting a resurrection. Now, Peter and John have run to the tomb to find it open and empty. They can't, you know, they're sort of pondering. They don't know what's going on. They wandered off. Mary has backtracked back to the tomb where Jesus meets her. The first post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to Mary. That is what happened when it says, and while they were on their way, because Mary is heading off to tell the disciples what she has seen. So, meanwhile, what happened to the Roman guard? While all this is going on, what is the Roman guard doing? Verse 11, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. So these battle-tested guard, which had just finally finished running for fear, gathered themselves together and started to think. Do you see, they are in deep trouble. We are talking getting killed trouble. You see, the Roman seal has been broken, the stone has been rolled away, the body is not in the tomb. Why was the Roman guard there? Two, make sure that the Roman seal was not broken, that the stone was not rolled away, and that there would still be a body in the tomb. They are in trouble. And with all the hoopla around this particular execution, what are they going to do? The logical thing for them to do would be report to their command structure, who then would report to Pilate, who then would order their executions. That would be the normal thing that should happen. Instead, they report to the chief priest and they tell him all that had happened. See, the only other people more interested in keeping this quiet than the Roman guard, is Adam. And he's not doing a very good job keeping it a secret at all. You know? Yeah. So meanwhile, back in the Roman guard, they know that the Sanhedrin has a vested interest in this outcome. Verse 12. And when they assembled with the elders and counseled together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers. You know what I find the most amazing thing about this text? Is that the Sanhedrin, the religious leadership, believed them. Imagine these babbling guards, these Romans, who you don't like anyway, run in. There was this angel, and then there's these white guys, and they were shining white, and they tossed this two-ton rock, and right. They believed them. That's the most amazing thing about the whole story. I mean, Romans and Jewish guys don't like each other. They're conning each other every chance they get. They're trying to get an edge on the other, to get an advantage. There's no assumption of a con. Matter of fact, even in the historical literature of the day, in some of the writers of the day, never even mentioned. Not even, you know, something that the subterfuge and deception that was just commonplace for those relationships between the Jews and the Romans. None of that is even assumed, implied, or even thought about in this narrative. What does the Sanhedrin do? They call a meeting. All hands on deck. All the significant decision makers are gathered. And when they assemble with the elders, they counsel together. And what do they decide? They have to make sure these soldiers are on their side. One of the reasons we know that these are Roman guards, if these were Jewish temple guards, there'd have been no problem. They would have control and authority over them, even of life and death. These are Roman guards that they have no authority over. So they give them a large sum of money to the soldiers. Verse 13. And said, "You are to say, his disciples came by night, stole him away while we were asleep." This is going to take a lot of money. See, the penalty for falling asleep on duty was that the officer would make rounds with a spear. And if you were asleep, he would just spear you. Usually with the end of your military career, not to mention your life. This is a clear penalty for this behavior. Historians record this event often. It was commonly carried out. For example, the first century Roman writer Petronius writes about these military issues extensively. This is what happened if you were asleep on duty. Now, first of all, point one. What we've seen the last few weeks, what has been the mindset of the disciples? Are they up for an exciting event? Or are they hiding for their lives, afraid that they're going to be next? Are they expecting a resurrection? What was Mary's words? After being told Jesus is risen from the dead by an angelic visitor, Jesus runs to Peter and John and say, "They've taken Jesus. We don't know where he is." The disciples are not planning a grave robbing. They are grieving a beloved friend. Second, if they had come by night and stole away while they were asleep, how did the Roman soldiers know who did it? You ever wonder that? It's like the little kid wakes up. "Johnny took my candy." "How do you know?" "Well, I was asleep." "But it had to be Johnny, right?" "No, it was Dad." Yeah, we know dads. Now, his disciple came and stole them away. How would they know? So between the chief priests and the elders, they decide they have to put together a story that explains the empty tomb. The body was stolen. Why this story? Why a story that is so clearly false? They didn't have a body. See, that was the purpose. That's what the guard was for. See, here's the way it was going. They knew that Jesus had said that Jesus, that 3 days later, he would raise. They even asked. They didn't ask for a guard permanently. They asked for a guard for 3 days. "Give us a guard for 3 days so the disciples don't come and steal the body." "There's your guard. Go and take it." So that if they claim Jesus rose from the dead, they produce a body. "Oh, is this the guy you're talking about who raised from the dead?" As they throw him into the courtyard. End of Christianity. All they had to do was fetch a body and Christianity dies. But instead, they create an outlandish story. Why? Because they know that Jesus is the Messiah. They had turned their back on their own Messiah. Because turning to Jesus could have jeopardized their situation. See, being a religious leader of a nation has its perks. You're able to bully Roman governors. You're able to manipulate the civil structures so that you can live very comfortably. You know, when Jesus cleared the tables in the temple, that was a Sanhedrin business. It was a way to exploit the people as they were coming to make their offerings in the temple so you could line your pocket. So they lied. Not an unintentional well-being lie, a doozy. I mean, not only did they make this outlandish lie, they spent lots of money to make it possible. And even with all that money, the soldiers know that if this reaches Pilate's ears, they would still be dead men, which they communicated to the religious leadership. Thus, verse 4. And if this should come to the governor's ear, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble. In the Greek, the emphasis is on the we and the you. We are in this together. There is a shared fear that the soldiers for their lives, the leadership for their position. Also, the grammatical form assumes that Pilate will hear. There's no denial on the religious leadership side that this is no big deal. It's going to go away. No, it's we understand this is a big deal, and very likely it won't go away, and we promise to take care of it, which means we will bribe Pilate also. I wonder what it takes to bribe a Roman governor. They're spending a lot of money for this lie, aren't they? Matter of fact, the whole set of assumptions of this situation, even among the secular historians of the day, everyone agrees the body's missing. The question is not what happened to it. We know that the Romans and the Jewish leaderships don't have it, because if they did, they would have produced it. And Christianity dies on the vine. If the disciples did sneak up on the armed, battle-tested Romans while they were actually asleep, they managed to move a 2-ton rock without waking a group of men who are under the penalty of death if they're caught asleep. Now that takes faith. And so if all this actually did happen, and each of the disciples then, except for John, would have been killed for what they knew was a lie. Right? 10 out of 11 disciples would die martyr's death proclaiming Jesus. John, on the other hand, he only got boiled in oil. Somehow I think he got the worst of it. How many of you, though, would be willing to be dipped in boiling oil for a lie? It's just difficult to believe that 11 men would endure tremendous hardship, even death, for what they knew was not true. That Jesus was God, and that their lives were transformed by indwelling spirit, and simply being in fellowship with Jesus, being in Christ, was worth their lives. So what do these battle-tested Roman soldiers who fled in fear do? Verse 15. Verse 15. And they took the money, did as they had been instructed, and this story was widely spread among the Jews even to this day. Matter of fact, there's even some later historical record that shows that not only did they do that, they also sent messengers to every known settlement telling them about Jesus and his death and the stolen body. There's some good evidence that Matthew is the first gospel written, and that it actually may have been written in Hebrew. Remember, most of the earlier believers are all Jewish, as was Jesus. So we are talking about a well-circulated book, possibly written within 5 years of this actual event. Matthew is chagrined that this clearly unbelievable story is still widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. In the Greek, there's no article. It actually better reads, widely spread among Jews. And that is why the event only appears in Matthew, but has since been mainstreamed. Gentiles like it also. Anything to dismiss God, right? And so, what did the leadership know? They knew that Jesus claimed deity. They knew that Jesus was claiming to be their Messiah. What did the religious leadership do? They had Jesus killed. They spent large amounts of money to cover it up. While the disciples were in hiding, because they thought they might be next, the Sanhedrin asked Pilate for a guard to put around the tomb. Pilate does more than that. He actually puts a seal on the tomb. Why? They are clearly aware of the fact that Jesus claimed deity. Jesus claimed that he would be crucified and that he would raise from the dead 3 days later to prove his point. That is a pretty compelling argument. You will know I am who I am because after you kill me, I will raise from the dead 3 days later. Just to prove the point. The religious leaders have become so comfortable. Had they reached a point in life of prestige, influence, power, they reached the point where they were lying to themselves. So much so that they were believing their own lies. I mean, they must have. I'm obviously speculating at that point, but how would you live with yourself after doing the things they were doing? I mean, you come home. Your wife greets you. Hey, dear, how was your day? Not bad. We killed the Messiah today. Outside of that, just your typical hypocritical religious day. Somehow, I don't see them doing that. So you see, the thing we need to remember, that even as saved saints, and make no mistake, because of the blood of Jesus, we are saints. But we are also sinners. Saved sinners, if you have received Jesus' shed blood as a payment for your sin. But we still have the capacity to sin. And so we must ask ourselves the question, in what ways am I like the religious leadership in our text this morning? Brothers and sisters, we have that same ability. We have the same ability to lie to ourselves and pretend and project good religious motives for despicable behavior. Right? We have that ability. You know, that is why we need to live in community with one another. We need to be in relationship with one another. We need relationships that keep us honest. Without it, we get in trouble really fast. I mean, the implications are huge. The power of this, if we really think about it, for example, young people. I mean, the $50 question with a young person is, who will love me for my rest of my life, right? Who will care about me? And so often we compromise that because we just want somebody to love us. Now, but think about it. If you are in or pursue a relationship with somebody who isn't submitted to spiritual authority, you're involved with someone who isn't, in essence, involved in a spiritual faith community, as people you respect and trust, who would have the power to speak into their lives or your life. What does that look like 20 years down the road? Probably like my parents. Divorced. You know? I mean, why did my mom marry, you know, four or five guys that all were the same? You know? Every one an alcoholic, except one. He was a dry alcoholic. He was the worst of the bunch. You know? Where were the people that talked to her and say, you know, Patty, why are you doing the same thing over and over again? Why do you keep making the same mistake over and over? You know, who was in her life that she would respect? That they had the authority and the power to speak? You know, and then as she passed into eternity, you know, I mean, I looked down and the thing that just naturally came out of my mouth, now, Mom, you know what it feels like to be loved. She spent her lifetime trying to be loved by all the wrong people. You know, who we choose to be in relationship with, if they are not in authority, if they're not in community, duck! Right? You know, young people, I mean, who you associate with, who you allow into your life, they have influence on you. Is it a good influence or a bad influence? Yeah. If you hide the choices you are making, how can we help you make better ones? Right? If we are hiding who we are and we are making decisions that are hurtful or that aren't getting us where we want to go, you know what? You know, if we don't know, we can't help. Because we are all predisposed to lie to ourselves, to make excuses, and eventually it looks as ugly as the Sanhedrin. Right? Authenticity, reality, being honest, transparency. We need one another. We need to be in mentoring, discipling, building relationships. We need to be in small groups, encouraging, nurturing. We need to be doing things together like children's church or Sunday school or, you know, or playing golf on Monday. You know? Where you saunter up to one another and say, who are you? How's it going? And we say the truth. Because otherwise it's lies, facades, and we end up looking like Pharisees. Life can be hard. We need one another. It gets off track way too easy. We need to be in the Word. We need to be in fellowship. Otherwise, we fall into hypocrisy. Hypocrisy does not happen without the lies that we tell ourselves. Isn't it great that not only did Jesus come and shed his blood so that we can spend eternity with him, amen? I mean, that is fantastic news, but he also saves us from ourselves. And that is a much, much bigger thing than we realize. So if you notice, there's been a little bit of a different order of service. And so we are going to stop now and have a chance to respond to God's grace in worship and song. Susan, you can come up.